is my old friend. I've come to talk with you again.
Don't go away.
There was a vision softly creeping, left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone, narrow streets of cobblestone. Turn my collar to the cold and damp. When my eyes were stabbed by the flash of a neon light that split the night and touched the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more. People talking without speaking. People hearing without listening. People writing songs and voices never shared. And no one dared disturb the sound of silence. Fool said, I, you do not know.
Well, it's the first time I've been on a Friday for a long time. Jeff Bennett here. Maggie called me earlier today. She had to be on the road, but she was going to be in a place where she could not rely on connection. And so she asked me to either see about rerunning one of her programs or rerunning one of mine. And I said, the heck with it, I'm going to go live. So I'm here on this Friday, Jeff Bennett, The Edge of Darkness tonight. It has been an interesting week. I'll not bore you with all of it. This heat is pure murder out here. I'm reading stories about saguaros literally dying because of this intense heat. We've had some, I don't know, 17, 18, 19 days of pure, absolute, nonstop heat. Even to the point that we're at over 100 degrees at night, in the middle of the night. It was so miserable yesterday, I didn't even get in the pool. Just couldn't even do it. I did get in there today, and it felt really good. Oh, my goodness. Putting the program together was easy, but it wasn't. I've not done lots of posting on websites, but all of a sudden things just kind of exploded and I posted a bunch of stuff. One of the more fascinating pieces that I posted on Federal Observer is a rather lengthy video. And I strongly urge each and every one of you to watch it. I believe it is in excess of an hour. It deals with this new film, The Sound of Freedom, with Jim Caviezel. And this is an amazing real-life inspiration. This film details Tim Ballard, his work as a special agent to fight against sex trafficking and child sex trade. And his interview goes into depth on the psychology of pedophilia, the nature of good and evil, how a steady faith in God has guided all three of these issues, but these people, Dr. Jordan B. Peterson, who's the host, Jim Caviezel, and Tim Ballard. Ballard is the founder and CEO of Operation Underground Railroad, or OUR, O-U-R, which locates and rescues endangered children victimized by sex trafficking rings. And previously, he accrued a decade of experience as a special agent in the Department of Homeland Security, working as an undercover op for the U.S. Child Sex Tourism Jump Team. Cavizel, if you're not familiar or you forget, is a American actor. Household name in no small part for his portrayal of Jesus in the film The Passion of the Christ. And next year there will be a sequel coming to that film. He has had a decades-long career both on and off the screen, is an advocate for faith in the modern world. The sound of freedom. The fight against worldwide child slavery and the sex trade. I strongly urge that you watch that video. As I said, it's on federalobserver.com right now. It says so much. And then I look at some of the things that are going on in the educational world. We'll kind of be jumping all around today. There's no specific direction of tonight's program. Just things to talk about, things to share, things to make you think about. My friend Mr. Benson submitted a new column to me earlier today that struck me instantly, called Little Red Classrooms. There is a group called Parents Defending Education has released a report showing how communist China has indoctrinated students in our public schools in this country, all the way through the K through 12 programming project, and it's called Confucius Classrooms. And this is a program that teaches Chinese language and culture. And if we understand communist China, just a wee bit of communist propaganda thrown in, oh, just for good measure. Confucius programming creates a so-called partnership between kindergarten through 12th grade schools, universities, and or nonprofits, and a Chinese government entity. And if you still think there is no communist propaganda in a setup like that, then I've got a bridge for sale in the Arizona desert that hasn't collapsed yet. And it's made of 100% genuine imitation gold bricks. Parents Defending Education has done their research, and they have found contracts showing that Confucius Classrooms and or other Chinese government programming is operating in Minnesota public schools, in Tulsa public schools in Oklahoma, in Seattle public schools in Washington. Who cares? No surprise in Seattle. And also in the Highland Park Independent School District in Texas. And, oh, there are others. Chinese Communist Party has had ties to school districts for nearly 20 years. I'm sorry. They've had ties to school districts in 20 U.S. military bases. Coincidence? No doubt. It has been noted that the People's Republic of China fostered relationships with American K through 12 schools through grants, sister school partnerships, and other programming since, oh, at least 2009. Parents Defending Education tracked affiliations in 143 schools across 34 states and Washington, D.C., and at least seven of them are still active. Financial exchanges between K through 12 schools and the Chinese government range from a few thousand dollars to, in Thomas Jefferson's case, more than $1 million. Disturbingly, the Chinese government ties appear to target school districts near 20 American military bases. And I've heard rumors that the Chinese are trying to buy large amounts of property near American military bases. So the Chinese government's effort to forge ties with American schools through its Ministry of Education is one facet of the Chinese Communist Party's broader soft power strategy to influence policy in nations throughout the world. Now, the State Department designated Confucius Institutes as a foreign mission of the Chinese Communist Party in 2020. The State Department. And Congress sits back and doesn't do one damn thing about it. I'll bet that the State Department under the Biden-Obama regime wouldn't do that today. Or would they? Oh, there's far more to this report, but there's too much for us to share with you today, but you can do some checking out for yourselves. Ain't too difficult to find. But this report was sent to 34 governors, key lawmakers, and committee chairs. I wonder what some of these people are going to do with this information, or if most of them will just deposit it in the circular file for the janitor to remove because they don't want the teachers' unions to be ticked off at them. After all, socialist teachers do vote. And they'd remember getting a report like this and who sent it to them. But we have put up with this if it was Soviet propaganda during the Cold War? Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, we did. Years ago, Neil read a book called Communist Propaganda in America, printed back in 1964. So you see, communist propaganda in American public schools is hardly a new or unusual problem now, is it? Most parents just do not realize how American education has been a communist target, and indeed was a target even back in the 1800s. Oh, it wasn't quite as obvious back then as it is now. Much of it slides by unreported because the educrats want communist propaganda in there to influence our children. Because if the truth were known, it makes their job so much easier. I mean, truth be told, they have much the same agenda as the Reds in Beijing. The creation of a socialist, communist America. You question that? You shouldn't. Unbelievable. Well, let's shift around a little bit. Let's touch on some medical issues. A piece that I came across, a couple of weeks ago, but it had been published in April of this year. You know, Wednesdays we typically deal with health-related issues. We talk about good health, bad health, cancer, other issues, heart, etc., etc. Before coming on the air tonight, I was questioning whether I wanted to go live, and I went back and began listening to a program that I had done, I think, in April of last year, 2022. It was a very interesting program. It dealt with health. The first half of the program dealt with health battles that I was combating at that point in time. And I know the second half of the program is going to deal with some things that Charles Dickens had written and some things that he talked about, some of the health issues, specifically as it relates to health care, the hospitals, et cetera, et cetera. Just to go. But this article I came across, thoroughly intrigued, because it kind of hit the nail on the head, that struck me was the title. Image that the originally used to publish this article. Ignorant white. Oops, how long have I been down? No, my keyboard got over the microphone, shut it off. 15 seconds, okay. So the point that I was bringing up is that the title of this article is Medical Schools Look for Activists, Not Healers. And the thing that was interesting that struck me was the title, but the image that was used by the author to promote his article. Picture of a bunch of ignorant white people, all with white shirts on, except for one guy. And they're all standing there waving LGBTQ flags. Come to think of it, that picture might have been taken in Seattle. Well, let me ask a question. What qualities should medical schools look for in future doctors? Well, probably academic excellence. I mean, experience in the medical sector, loyalty to medical ethics, and good interpersonal skills. Now, friends, these are all characteristics that future doctors should have. But they're not what medical schools are now emphasizing. No, medical schools today are looking for social justice zealots to advance the diversity, the equity, and the inclusion dogmas. I could be a little gross. We'll just say dog poop. Well, no, look no further than medical school applications. Because it's the top-ranked medical school in the nation. Americans expect Harvard Medical School to share their concern for academic excellence. But excellence, however, is no longer Harvard's focus. Identity politics is. Harvard asks applicants to share, quote, an important aspect of their personal background or identity, end quote. And then the school expressly suggests that applicants focus on significant challenges in access to education or unusual socioeconomic factors, maybe identification with a minority culture, religion, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, or gender identity. All of this is what Harvard is asking for? Well, we got to admit to it. A rags to riches story is heartwarming, and a tale of two or more genders is trendy. Whether a medical doctor aced anatomy and physiology ought to be more important. John Hopkins University School of Medicine, they at least makes this pandering optional in its application process, and yet it too neglects one of the most germane aspects of a medical school application, namely whether the applicant has any relevant experience in the field of medicine. Whether it be an internship or EMT work or maybe shadowing at a hospital, you think that experience related to medicine would be central to your application success. But instead, Hopkins cares about applicants' experience as, quote, part of a minority group, whether because of your sexual orientation, religion, economic status, gender identity, ethnicity, on and on and on, ad nauseum. Boy, Johns Hopkins' experience in a minority group seems to trump experience with a scalpel. For the Duke University School of Medicine, one question about identity politics isn't enough. Oh no, the school asks three. Duke doesn't seem to want doctors to heal the body as much as it wants activists to heal health inequities produced by race, gender, education, income, disability, geographic location, oh, and let's not forget sexual orientation. Then there's the University of Minnesota's medical school. They don't ask applicants about any prior medical experience. It simply asks them to respond to the university's statement of solidarity with the Black Lives Matter organization. University of Minnesota, these are their very words. Right now is a watershed moment in American history and this country's reckoning with race, racism, racial injustice, and especially anti-black hatred. If you feel comfortable, we welcome you to please share with us your reflections on experiences with and greatest lessons learned about systemic racism that is receiving international attention with the murders of numerous black indigenous people of color, including but not limited to George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Vanessa Gulen, Rayshard Brooks, and Elijah McClain. End of quote. University of Minnesota's medical school does not even try to make this a statement about medicine or the qualities that make a good doctor. Would it not make more sense to ask prospective doctors to maybe draw inspiration from leaders in medicine, such as Jonas Salk or Alexander Fleming, or how about Ben Carson? Perhaps, but medical schools aren't looking for sense either. What better way to stymie medical talent than not to look for it in applicants to medical school? By focusing on characteristics unrelated to medicine, these schools send a message that qualified but non-woke applicants need not apply. Do you think an application or an applicant who answered these questions from a conservative point of view would be admitted? How about a student who simply professed neutrality on these issues? Sorry, folks, but the ideologues running medical school admissions believe that neutrality is just a cover for racism and sexism and homophobia or transphobia, that risks reinforcing existing power struggles. Medical schools are discouraging potential candidates based on their political opinions. They're admitting those who seek to be activists first, healers second. This, my friends, is educational malpractice. It could well yield medical malpractice in the future. But the tragic irony, as with so many liberal policies, is that the primary victims of this malpractice will be none other than America's sick and elderly and poor. But then ultimately everyone bears the risk that one day we'll be treated by a doctor dumbed down by ideology. But when you're on the operating table, will you care more about whether your surgeon is steeped in critical race theory or is dedicated to saving lives and improving health outcomes for his or her patients, regardless of their skin color, their sexual orientation, or their gender identity? Medical schools, my friends, and every other American institution for that matter, ought to prioritize excellence and merit. The alternative is national decay. It is just amazingly profound to me some of this stuff that we come across. Obviously, that piece, Medical Schools Look for Activists, is published at drkelly.net. And following it up, which we're not going to probably get into, is another very profound piece. Actually, it's fairly short. I think I will share it with you. It deals with the wrong diagnosis. And of course, given the story we've just shared with you, it begins to make me wonder if the wrong diagnosis is because of the way that these characters are being allowed to enter medical schools with their mindset and how they're coming out. Wrong diagnosis kills hundreds of thousands in this country every year. The number of Americans who suffer permanent consequences from medical misdiagnosis is higher than previously thought. That according to a new study, but there are some simple steps that we can take to lower our risk. Oh, here we go. Study from researchers at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine found that an estimated 795,000 Americans suffer permanent disability or death as the result of medical misdiagnosis, and there is a chance that the number could be as high as 1.02 million people. Well, maybe Johns Hopkins needs to read the story that we just shared with you, and they need to take a look in the mirror of the kind of people they are training to be medical professionals. Of the patients who are misdiagnosed, the researchers said nearly half die. Diagnostic errors are by a wide margin the most under-resourced public health crisis we face. That according to Dr. David Newman Toker, director of the Johns Hopkins Diagnosis Excellence Center. Maybe Dr. David Newman Toker needs to take a close look at the caliber of people they're training, teaching. Now, the top five most misdiagnosed diseases represented 38.7% of all misdiagnosed cases. Stroke, sepsis, pneumonia, venous thromboembolism, that's blood clots in the veins, and lung cancer. According to research, these diagnostic errors often occur when patients exhibit symptoms other than those most commonly associated with the disease. Now, in the case of strokes, we all know the classic symptoms, weakness on one side, slurred speech, etc., etc. And yet, during an appearance on CNN's The Lead with Jake Tapper, chief medical correspondent Dr. Sanjay Gupta said there could also be other signs such as dizziness, headaches, fatigue that are more likely to be dismissed by doctors as something less severe. And while adverse outcomes are still rare, according to Gupta, there are some simple questions that patients can ask their doctor to lower their risk even further. Some of those questions might be, what could be causing my problem? What else could it be? When will I get my test results, and what should I do to follow up? In particular, Gupta called the second one very important follow-up question that you should ask. For doctors who see hundreds of thousands of patients, it may be necessary to help them think outside the box and beyond the day-to-day. The good news, according to the research authors, is that only 15% account for more than 50% of the misdiagnosis. Better awareness of less common symptoms and treatments for those diseases could lead to less frequent diagnostic errors. And one example is lung cancer. The American Cancer Society now recommends people with a high risk of lung cancer get a low-dose CT scan. And that screening tool has a much better chance than traditional chest x-rays of detecting the disease early. And while we would all love for the doctors to get it right every time, we're talking about complex diseases with someone or sometimes mysterious presentations. Patient awareness and questioning and ongoing research can be our most potent weapons against this health crisis. What I've just shared with you is written by Cork Gaines for Business Insider, published about a week ago. This final paragraph that we just shared, while we would all love for the doctors to get it right every time. Now, our previous story indicates that that ain't going to happen. But we have a degree of responsibility of our own health. Patient awareness. Questioning. We must question. Oh, and by the way, ask your doctor if a drug with 32 pages of side effects is right for you. That just happens to be the image I've got posted along with this article. Wrong diagnosis kills hundreds of thousands in the U.S. each year. Oh, I've been keeping busy. Another piece we've got posted I'm not going to get into. Johnson & Johnson has now sued researchers who have linked talc to cancer. Like baby powder? They don't like the fact that they've been sued up the wazoo for, you know, $2.8 billion or whatever the heck it is. And the scams and the games that they're continuing to play to avoid having to pay out. Take a look at it. Johnson & Johnson sues researchers who link talc to cancer. Another piece that I don't think I've discussed now because we've not really done a health program in a couple of weeks. Foreign countries with drug price controls ride for free on a U.S. investment. And I've talked about this from my own personal standpoint. Yeah. Quite interesting. As I look at the cost of drugs, I look at what we're paying in this country, and yet you can go to Canada, you can go to Mexico, and buy the same exact drugs for considerably less. Now, I am not going to travel to Mexico because my concern is it'll probably be full of fentanyl anyway, but well, that's a story for another day I'm working on. But there's some good news. You know who Mark Cuban is? He's got a commercial on television right now that I absolutely hate. It's a commercial for State Farm Insurance. And this black chick gets off a bus talking to this guy she knows, and he's telling her she could do this, do that. So next thing, she's all set. She's dressed differently. She's got some very expensive tennis shoes on. She's sitting in a room with sunglasses on, feet up on the desk. And Mark Cuban, who's one of the hosts of, I don't know, some show on TV where they try to con the hosts into investing money in whatever they've invented. Well, Mark Cuban in this commercial is being Mark Cuban, but he's now playing somebody trying to sell his black gal this nonsense. But Mark Cuban's an interesting guy. And when I came across this today, I fell out of my tree. Mark Cuban has joined forces to spread the availability of low-cost prescription drugs. And the partnership that he has created with, believe it or not, Kroger, could be bad news for pharmacy benefit managers. You see, little by little, the pharmacy benefit managers, or PBMs, as it were, are getting their comeuppance, and American consumers are getting their due when it comes to the cost of prescription drugs. And let me tell you something. This struck me more in the last 4 weeks than it has in the last nearly 2 years that I've been on meds. No, when I have a prescription that I paid $130-some-odd for a 90-day supply in January, and in April it renewed it in the upper 400s, and I just had to renew it again in the upper 400s, in addition to another one of my prescriptions for a 90-day period for the upper 400s. Now I'm ticked off. Well, Mark Cuban's got an operation called Cost Plus Drugs. And he's cut a deal with Kroger that's going to give consumers in 35 states the power to find the lowest price for prescription drug. So anybody who's watched Shark Tank knows that Cuban is a take-no-prisoners kind of guy and apparently sees an opportunity when it comes to high-priced drugs. And the cost-plus business model is simple. It marks up each drug by 15% and has a $3 pharmacy fee where applicable. And the company makes a profit. The customers can finally get their prescriptions filled without taking out a damn loan. And Cuban's company said the deal includes more than 2,000 of the different Kroger family stores. Some of these companies I've never heard of. Baker's, City Market, Dillon's, Food for Less, Foods Company, Fred Meyer, Fry's, Gerby's, J.C. Food Store, King Supers, Kroger, Mariano's, Metro Market, Pay Less Supermarkets, Pick and Save, QFC, Ralph's, Ruler, and Smith's Food and Drugs. And we're about to learn that the cost savings are unbelievably impressive. One of the beauties of Cuban's business model is transparency. For example, when Consumer Affairs researched the price of the most prescribed drugs in the U.S., Cost Plus listed amlodipine, a drug that nearly 70 million Americans take to treat excessive blood pressure and manage coronary artery disease. It's available at Cost Plus for $3.60. That's a 30-count supply of a 2.5-milligram dosage. And Cost Plus will also show you the price at other pharmacies, $50.10. It costs 30 cents to manufacture the drug. Cost Plus gets a 15% markup, which is 30 cents. The pharmacy's labor fee is $3. The total savings to the customer is $46.50. Now we go check another drug called pantoprazole. 20th most prescribed drug. Comes in at a purchase price of $4.50. Cost Plus also displayed the $71.40 price that it would cost at other pharmacies. What it costs to manufacture the drug is $1.20. Cost Plus is 15% markup is 30 cents. The pharmacy's labor fee, $3. The total savings to the customer is $66.90. And Cuban claims that those prices could get even better, too. He says, as we grow and as our costs go down, we will always pass those savings on to you, he said in his company's mission statement. Wow. Cost Plus could be a thorn on the side of the PBMs. Because the industry also faces regulatory pressure. An FTC committee recently voted to withdraw its opposition to state legislation that would boost transparency over entities managing prescription drug benefits. The vote is the latest chess move in the agency's effort to contemporize its view of PBMs. Oh, here's a lot going on with PBMs. In the FTC's viewpoint, they act as middlemen. They negotiate rebates and fees with drug manufacturers, create drug formularies, which are lists of medications that are covered by insurance, reimburse pharmacies for patients' prescriptions, etc., ad nauseum. But the two things currently at the heart of the FTC's investigation are whether or not PBM practices are anti-competitive or whether they hinder patient access to affordable medications. Susanna of Pasadena, California, wrote in a consumer affairs review of Express Scripts recently, she said, "I have no choice but to use this company for my employer-sponsored health care plan." And out of the blue, with no justice, no notice, they denied a prescription I've been taking through them for the past several years. They claim I need to try generic when there is no generic equivalent. Basically, they are forcing her off of a doctor-prescribed medication that she needs to function with no recourse. Well, PBMs and drug manufacturers have long argued about who is responsible for high drug prices. In a recent report, the Bipartisan Policy Center said that there is evidence PBMs may be passing too little of that savings on to customers. But then they left open the question whether PBMs are the right target. Well, Express Scripts won't be the only company that may be asked to explain itself. The compulsory orders will require the other large PBMs in the U.S. to provide information and records on their business practices as well. And those companies include CVS Caremark, Express Scripts, Inc., Optum Rx, Inc., Humana Pharmacy Solutions, Inc., Prime Therapeutics, LLC, and Meta Impact Healthcare Systems, Inc., Health Services, LLC, and Accent Health Services, LLC. Kind of makes you wonder who else. My wife stopped, well, we don't deal with CVS. My wife stopped dealing with Walgreens quite some time ago because she happens to be doing all of her business over at Fry's. Fry's. Part of the Kroger family of businesses. Needs to say where I'll be moving my stuff very soon. But then I'm not due for any renewals in quite a while. Simply amazing what we're dealing with. Absolutely amazing what we're dealing with. By the way, that the Kroger and Mark Cuban piece, I've done something very unusual. That column is published in its entirety at drkelly.net. However, you will find that I also have it published in part on Sierra Madre Precious Metals.com and FederalObserver.com. When you go to either one of those sites, Federal Observer or Sierra Madre, you're going to get the first couple of paragraphs. It's kind of worth looking at all three of the sites to see the introduction of this Kroger and Mark Cuban article. I have used different images on each one of those sites. And, of course, it's, I think Federal Observer's got the really oddball image. Nope. Federal Observer's actually got a very serious piece with a stethoscope and a bunch of $105 and $10 bills with a bunch of pills all over it. It is Sierra Madre Precious Metals that has got the most interesting image. A medicine man standing in front of his covered wagon with his top hat on and his long tail 1880s Western type suit. Oh, that's Dr. Fauci. Yeah. Well, I'm going to share this with you. I've not done this for a while. It's a quotation which I altered many years ago from a book dealing with the fall of Rome. All I did was change a few words. The phrase, "the fall of America," suggests some cataclysmic event, end of the American Empire, which is stretched from Maine to California and Florida to Washington. But at the end, there was no straining at the gates, no barbarian horde that dispatched the Empire in one fell swoop. Rather, the Empire fell slowly as a result of challenges from within and without, and changing over the course of hundreds of years until its form was unrecognizable. Well, here we are. Biden and company are full throttle on their way to damning America and her people to a miserable existence in the worst imaginable world of all possibilities and poverty. If we fail to stop them with a fiercely driven and motivated decisive victory that ends the question forever of which path America will take into the rest of this century and beyond. The Democratic Party communists and our enemies from within, and those Keynesian Marxist economies of ill repute, have regularly misled our people with tales of a ready prosperity to be had by all. Just around the bend of their troubled road, in the middle of the country's economic troubles, from the earliest days of the FDR administration to the present. And my friends, their only intent has always been to pacify the middle class, keep them docile as possible to prevent any civil strife from rising and growing into an open revolt. And since the American middle class has always been largely conservative and the greatest potential threat to any corrupt regime, and now that many conservative, independent, and Christian Americans are no longer willing to continue to bow to fascist corporations' woke demands at the behest of the communists within our federal government, we are witnessing, at long last, the demise of financialization, because too many of us currently see the inevitable end game of an uncontrolled economic implosion. Now, friends, over the decades, the drive to protect their market niches and their market monopolies has motivated corporations to seek and very nearly demand massive government subsidies on a regular basis, which has resulted in hyper-stimulation of the economy and the hyper-financialization of American life, all in a way that has fatally distorted Americans' values, their social order, their production, their politics. I mean, think about some of what I've just shared with you. The drive to protect their market niches and their market monopolies has motivated corporations to seek and very nearly demand massive government subsidies on a regular basis. So much of that deals with the piece that we've just shared with you. Think about that. Dealing with Kroger and Mark Cuban, trying to be out here dealing with people the real way, giving them fair prices for unbelievable stuff. But you see, one can rest assured that all America is either laughing their heads off or bursting a blood vessel in anger at hearing old crazy Joe's assertion that he has cut inflation in half under Bidenomics. Jeez, what a jerk. The people can plainly see that inflation isn't going anywhere soon. Certainly not down. Consumer price index might fluctuate a bit, but the effects of inflation stick around as prices tend to increase and stay high far into the future. All short of wiping the slate completely clean and starting everyone off from a state of new poverty. No, we're heading down the same path that saw a loaf of bread cost 200 billion marks during the collapse of the Weimar Republic, as hyperinflation destroyed its economy. In the autumn of 1923, workers on hourly wages discovered that their wages were worthless because prices had risen since they began their shifts. You see, our leaders seem incapable or unwilling to face the reality of what's to come. It doesn't affect them, because they're getting too much money into the table. If some hard choices aren't made and this nation does not tighten its belt and become considerably more financially responsible, we're all going to face the reality of what's to come. My friend Justin Smith says he can handle whatever is to come, but it tears me apart to think that the evil and the greed of these current monsters in power may well cause significant suffering for my children and grandchildren. And he goes to a dark place in his mind as he thinks as to how he's going to respond. Stand by. Next week, there will be more to come from Justin O. Smith on this issue. Justin has this tendency, not intentionally, to basically write two different columns at the same time. Oh, they're all related to one another. They're both related to one another. When he submits a new column for me to for consideration for publication, and I publish about 90% of them. It's not that I disagree with those that I don't publish. It's time. It's time related. And I can't necessarily just post two and three of his pieces of writing every week to take over the websites. I've got other people I've got to get stuff in. But earlier this week, I'd published a piece by Justin called A Personal Note. And that's, in fact, what it was. It was a personal note to me. But it was so intriguing that I decided to publish it on its own. In effect, I have just shared with you another personal note entitled Mourning for America. And next week, we're going to get into the crux of all of that. Between the writings of Justin O. Smith, Charles Dickens, I think that I recently published a piece by, The Little Red Classrooms by Mr. Benson. He writes new pieces every week. New piece by Neil Ross. I don't publish as much of Neil's stuff as I once did because, for starters, it's way too in-depth. I hate to say it, it's over the head of so many people. But his latest piece is entitled, Don't Let Them Control Your Mind. And it's on Federal Observer, and it's well worth reading. The relationship I have with some of these writers has been long and intense. I want to thank all of you for allow me to come into your homes tonight, this Friday night, for the first time in a long time. Maggie should be back on Monday. Lord willing, I'll see you next Tuesday. Without apology, I am Jeffrey Bennett. These silent days of the open hand, we will not be the last. Look around now, these are the days of the beggars and the choosers. This is the year of the hungry man, whose place is in the past. Hand in hand with ignorance and legitimate excuses,
the rich declare themselves poor, and most of us are not sure if we have it too much, but we're taking our chances, say. I sang 20 years and a day, but nothing changed. The human race found some other guy and walked into the flame. It's hard to love, there's so much to hate. Hanging on to hope when there is no hope to speak out. Dead skies above say it's much too late. Then maybe we should all be praying for time. Do-do-do-oh. Do you think we have time? Do you think we have time? These are the days of the empty hand. Oh, we hold on to what you can. Charity, charity is the coat you wear twice a year, yeah, yeah. This is the year of the guilty man. Your television takes a stand, and you find that what was over there is over here. So you scream from behind your door, say what's mine is mine and not yours. I may have too much, but I'll take all my chances, say. I sang it 20 years and a day. There's nothing changed. The human race found some other guy and walked into the flames. It's hard to love. Jesus has so much to hate. Hanging on to hope. There is no hope to speak out. Say it's much too late. Then maybe we should all be praying for time.
Have you been looking for a trusted long-term storable food company? We have a solution for you. Simply Clean Foods is dedicated to providing the best quality food you can buy next to fresh from a farmer's market. Our line of resealable fruits, vegetables, and meats are suitable for everyday use, and you won't have to worry about throwing away valuable groceries ever again. Our food is completely GMO-free, and our stringent quality controls, plus testing for heavy metals, makes us unique in the storable foods market. Simply Clean Foods' primary focus is to bring clean food to people all around the world and change the way we look at freeze-dried food in our daily cooking. When you purchase from Simply Clean Foods, not only will you be receiving high-quality food, but you will also be supporting veterans in need across the country and those who are affected by natural disasters.
Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on long-term food storage in the rotating sponsors banners to support RBN.
Simply Clean Foods. Do it today.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.